let's get started. I have some slides to kind of frame the discussion a bit. And so everybody should try opening those slides. Simplest thing to do is just download them and then just go through them locally.
The VNC is working too, so.
You can also do it. Where is the VNC listed here? 3E9T.
Right.
At 3E9T on the session page, you'll see a link to get to the VNC. So that's an alternative way to do it. Either one will be just fine. So let's begin on the first slide. It's just, this is an OOR funding workshop. We're going to be brainstorming and rethinking our funding strategy. So in these slides, I'm going to talk a little bit about strategies and some of the experiences that we've had already. So if you move to slide 2, so first let's look at the current funding status. NCBO is one of the founders of, or Mark Musin, head of NCBO, is a founder of OOR, one of the founders. And they have generously given their time and code. Well, their code is open source, but they certainly have been helpful with us and giving us the base code for the OOR that we're currently using. They're a well-funded NIH center. They specialize in biomedical ontologies. Their server is centralized rather than federated as we envision. So it's somewhat different strategy on their part. And they don't specifically have a mandate to support the OOR or produce code for the OOR. Their mandate is simply to have a repository of biomedical ontologies. And so it's their code is definitely very specialized for that purpose. The Keeper Project is a project that I ran. This was funded as part of another NIH project, which is over. That's ended. The Keeper Project handled gatekeeping, workflow, and policy enforcement. It was not integrated with the BioPortal code. It predates our use of BioPortal as the base code. We're looking into possibility of trying to integrate it with BioPortal, but that hasn't happened yet. So then moving on to slide 3, there's the geospatial, this is the spatial ontology community of practice as an OOR. That was, I believe that was also funded as part of a grant that's an NSF project, I believe.
Yeah, NSF Interop.
NSF Interop, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
One of the Interop projects.
Right. I looked at them recently. They contain 24 ontologies. Not all of them are actually geospatial. Some of them are just more generic. I'm not sure to what extent they have contributed actual code to the OOR. They certainly have contributed a lot of enthusiasm for the OOR, and that's been quite helpful. Perhaps somebody else could tell me to what extent they've actually been involved in the OOR. Is anybody here today involved in the SOCOP community of practice?
Yeah, Mike Dean and Peter.
Yes.
Yeah, and contribution of content is sort of first class citizen as much as contribution of code. So.
Oh yeah. Okay. I just wasn't sure to what extent they contributed code.
Right, so.
I certainly know that they contributed content, and I mentioned that. Then other projects, we do have a number of other OOR instances, but I don't know to what extent any of these other projects actually explicitly mention OOR in their proposal. I just know that the SOCOP and, of course, my project explicitly mentioned it. And so that gave us a little bit of experience with what the reaction would be from these funding agencies, and also what happens when you have such a sub-project. Okay, so that's kind of basically the funding status that we have right now. Let's move on to slide 4, and now I'll talk a little bit about general funding opportunities. Of course, there are many funding strategies. We could seek project funding from some funding source, and that's what we've been doing up to now, trying to find some sort of agency grant. Or another possibility would be to incorporate, for example, as a consortium, and there have been a number of consortiums in the past that have been successful at producing projects of this nature. That's certainly another possibility. There could be other strategies as well. Hopefully people will have some good ideas today when we get to the discussion. There are many potential sources of project funding, government agencies, charitable foundations, as well as for-profit corporations. The incorporation strategy, on the other hand, that requires a business plan, but you still have to be concerned about funding. I mean, you have to get funding from somewhere, and that has to be a central part of the plan. So ultimately, all of these involve approaching various sources of funding for some kind of support. So even though we've been mainly seeking project funding, the same kinds of issues will come up no matter what strategy we ultimately decide to follow. So now let me go through for the rest of the slides discussing the experience that we had for funding the OOR. And as I've said before, the focus is on project funding. But although this is our only experience so far, any form of funding would require making a case to funding sources. And so it's very likely that the same kinds of issues would come up. Okay, so moving on to slide 6. Now, obtaining project funding involves two main parts, making the case or merit, and this has multiple components, which I'll be talking about in later slides. And then another very important aspect is compatibility with the funding source mission. So this funding source will have some kind of mission. For-profit organizations, for example, definitely have a business plan and a mission statement, and they definitely require that any funding they give will be compatible with their overall objectives and mission. The same goes for any kind of funding source in government and private foundations. So each of these different funding sources will have an evaluation process. There's a lot of variation among the various sources on what the process is. Some of these funding sources will carefully separate the merit issue from the compatibility with the funding source. NIH is like that, for example. In that case, you can get some really good feedback about to what extent, your project, your proposal has good merit, but it might not actually be funded largely because it doesn't match their mission. Other sources, like the NSF, for example, don't particularly separate these two from one another, so any kind of feedback you get will tend to mix them up. Vaguely worded mission statements are very common, I've discovered. I mean, you'll see mission statements that are program objectives, and things like that. They're so vaguely worded that they could apply to almost anything. That basically means that it's left up to the discretion of the program manager to decide who actually gets funded. In a case like that, you generally have to develop a fairly close relationship with the program manager to get funding. So this is probably quite common for corporate funding. It's also common, in my experience, for military, if you go to military funding. So now let me talk a little bit more detail about merit. This is the making the case aspect. Typical merit categories are divided up into significance, the investigators, innovation, approach, and environment. Of course, this will vary a great deal from one funding source to another. There are also auxiliary sections of the proposal. You have to have some kind of budget. You have to justify it. And in some cases, you'll need to specify how your resources are going to be shared, if they're going to be shared at all. Moving on to slide 8. Well, let me get a little overview of the results that we've had for past proposals. In the significance area, we've been outstanding. This is the importance that the work will have, assuming it's successfully completed. We've gotten very, very high scores on this. The indications that this is critical, that it's fundamental. These are the most positive words you could possibly say about any proposal. Investigators is another one. This is another criterion. That the personnel are well-suited, that you cover all the bases. Our proposals have also scored highly on this criterion. The only potential weakness we might have in that is that we tend not to well specify what other personnel other than kind of the key personnel, who they are and you know, what their background is. But that may not be such a big, very important. My experience is that isn't something that would really be a significant problem with the proposal. Moving on to slide 9, these are some more results. In the innovation area, this is the novelty of the proposed project. This is really hard. It's really hard to make a case for the novelty of the OOR as a research project. It is, after all, using fairly well-known techniques, just putting them together in a way which is quite good, you know, quite new. So while it can be made that we have novelty, my experience is that it's very hard to do this. They tend not to be that impressed by the novelty of it, particularly because ontology repositories have already been developed. One way of dealing with this is to include OOR as part of another project, which will then have sufficient novelty to make the case for this aspect, for this part of this criterion for fundability. Of course, not all funding sources emphasize innovation as much as others. The next criterion you often see is approach. Of course, this is what your project will actually do. This one we've been rather weak. We tend to emphasize what the requirements are. So we're thinking a lot, and, you know, we are software engineers for the most part. We think of that as being the specification of what is going to be done. Unfortunately, that's not what most of the people who review the proposal want to see. They want to see an actual, list of tasks and exactly what you're going to be doing in those tasks in much more detail than we have been up to now. This is solvable. We can certainly write our proposal in a way which satisfies for this criterion a little bit better. Now moving on to slide 10, the environment is concerned with what the equipment and software and such that we're going to have that's going to be used in the project. And we've actually been very good on this criterion, and it's actually seldom an important one for a project such as the OOR. Peter's infrastructure, for example, is you know, definitely an excellent way to convince someone that we have the necessary infrastructure to support this. In projects where you actually have hardware and you're building new kinds of hardware, then you have a lot more attention paid to something like this. But that's not something that we're doing. Budget is another one that we've been a little bit weak on, that mainly because we haven't been as detailed in discussing what our approach is, what the tasks are. Again, this is solvable by just being more detailed in what the tasks will be and what will be done in those tasks. And, of course, who is going to be doing them. Going on to slide 11, the few more kinds of issues that have come up are resource sharing. This is the plan for sharing what we're going to produce. That's something that we're really good at because it's an open source project and we do have experience with open source. The only potential weakness is how we can argue for long-term support for this after the project funding runs out. There are ways of dealing with that. As I say, it's only a potential weakness. Not all funding sources emphasize this this issue. Finally, there's just this overall issue of compatibility with the mission, and this is one of the worst things, unfortunately, of our proposals. The problem is that infrastructure development in these funding agencies like the NSF is seldom they just don't have that in their mission statement. Including the OR is one way that we could approach this, and that's of course what that helps with the. But there may be other possible ways of approaching this issue. Moving on to slide 12, of course. Now, as I said, in two cases we have had OOR explicitly mentioned as a sub-project. The advantage is that this is one way that we can address some of the criteria and these projects were actually funded. The disadvantage is that it we definitely have to well integrate the project objective, well integrate the OOR with project objectives to avoid an adverse impact on the evaluation. So, you know, if we just sort of add into the project, oh, by the way, we're also going to have a certain amount of work on OOR, then the evaluators are going to say, well, this really doesn't have anything to do with your main project, and they would just cut it. Evaluators will do that. I've been on many, many panels, and we do that all the time. You really have to integrate and make it clear that this is fundamental to your project, or they'll just simply cut it. Unfortunately, that means that support for the main project will dictate design choices in the OOR, which may not actually be what we would like to have as we've been developing our OOR requirements over the years. Finally, it's a low priority within the main project, and what that means is that if other objectives of the project become, you know, start running late, you know, or some difficulties occur, this could be something that will not get very much attention. So those are all disadvantages, but in a couple of cases, especially the Keeper case, it certainly has worked well, and an actual code was developed for the OOR according to the requirements and objectives of the OOR. So it certainly can be done. We have done it. Going on to slide 13, this is another possibility that's been suggested, is that we make a consortium, this has the advantage that it's another solution, an alternative solution to some of the criteria for funding that might actually be quite effective. The disadvantages are that, well, again, it's going to be effectively a sub-project of many other projects, so it may have basically the same disadvantages. In other words, if we make it a consortium, we're basically saying we have all of these other projects or all these other companies in the consortium, each of which is basically a project that will want OOR as something that will contribute to that project. And so, you know, basically the same sorts of issues will come up as were on the previous slide, slide 12. Because basically, as I say here, different domains have different requirements, and that can be a problem when you try to group together a number of these projects or companies or domains into a single consortium. Another issue is it's not clear how much experience do we have for such an approach. Perhaps some of the people here at the meeting today can, help by giving some of their experiences and some insight into whether this is a viable approach. So finally, in slide 14, what we're looking for today is suggestions. This is an open meeting to get basically a brainstorming session, talk about possibilities for funding. I've tried to give a kind of framework for this, but please feel free to, give your ideas for possibilities that you think could definitely be viable. If you're going to make suggestions, try to be specific enough to say what the funding source or sources are going to be, and if it's going to be a sub-project, what domain you're going to have, what target domain. I suggest that we should not target either biomedical or geospatial, because those domains are already pretty well covered. The biomedical, of course, covered by NCBO and BioPortal, and geospatial by SOCOP. Also, it would be helpful to have some pointers to a potential investigator and team who might be able to work with us, and of course the kinds of project objectives, and with the aim there of determining to what extent it is compatible with what the OOR would like to accomplish. Of course, be sure to, you know, if you have other ideas, please tell us. Okay, I'd like to open it now, open the meeting to a general discussion. There's a chat room here. Peter has listed the instances, and if you just go to OOR.net, you can see them. I don't see anyone's hand raised. You can, on the chat room, you can just click on the hand and okay, Peter, would you like to speak
yes.
now?
Just for whoever typed in testing next to the hand, if you have a message to put on the chat board, do it in the box below that. Nominally, just clicking on the hand button will do, because that sort of cues you up for funding. So I have a couple of thoughts to share with everyone. Way back, I mean, in 2008, around the time we first started, I had some conversation with Mark Musen, as Ken mentioned. And, of course, around that time, Mark was getting funding, too. And of course, he successfully garnered about $37 million to fund the NCBO BioPortal project, which is great. And OOR actually ended up not having been sort of officially funded as a whole. Evidently, all the components and all the contributors to the OOR team has been funded in one way or another, but the overall OOR initiative has been a volunteered initiative. I think it's about time we address this, because if we look at our mission, we have a very sort of ambitious vision that calls for huge impact, and it calls for some sort of sustainable operations. Volunteered efforts may or may not be as sustainable, I mean, in the type of sort of major impact situation as one would want to be. It's a great way to get started. It's probably not the greatest way to go into sustained operation. So and since we are more than 4 years into the works we have done a few things that are fairly impressive, I still think. It's about time we address the funding issue. I had interacted with a lot of possibilities over the last 4 years. I still remember Mark Musen at one point, at a very early stage, was sort of characterizing the situation. And at one point, he did say in one of his talks, actually, OOR should be a foundation in no time. And I sort of agree with him. A foundation is probably the type of model that we should aim at ultimately. Not just a foundation, but maybe a foundation with some sort of an endowment. I mean, if you ask me, if you can get anything you want, what would you want? Then I would say maybe we get ourselves established with some sort of an endowment so that operating expenses could be paid for through the endowment, and then we could come up with business models, monetization strategies that would help us work into a sustainable mode. None of these things have been thought over, so I hope we could use today's session to run through those different scenarios and see what could be done. I also had extensive discussions with NSF. Between Mark and myself, we've submitted like eager proposals, we've submitted specific project response proposals to solicitations. I have spoken with them, and generally NSF, of course, funds research, and their target is mainly universities, which we aren't to start with. And then even if they fund certain projects, they look at those projects to be just kick-started and could run into sustainable funding themselves. So it goes back to the same thing. Even if a project like us, ours gets some sort of cyber infrastructure offices funding, they would maybe fund it for 3 years, 5 years, and then they expect you to be able to be on your own. We've already been 4 years, without such funding. So we might as well look at the next step rather than the type of research grants or research-centric grants that provides that kind of support. Also, NSF actually has been extremely supportive of what we call a sort of tax model. He said, I mean, go become part of other projects and tax them. In fact, if we go back onto the SOCOP proposal, they specifically mentioned OR, they were funded, and within the evaluation, they actually, the fact that they were teamed up with OR actually became one of the very positive criteria that they got support for. So NSF is supportive of our becoming sub-projects and quote-unquote taxing those projects so we get a part of the funding from those projects to fund our work. So if there are like 20 or 30 or 50 of those projects that we are a part of, we could possibly get that kind of sustainable operating funding. But then we still have still need some sort of organization to do that, and that goes back to maybe a foundation, or as Ken uses the term consortium, a consortium model might be good. Role models that we could possibly look at, I remember Mike Dean did say at the 2008 Ontology Summit, say that we might look at Apache as a sort of good model to follow in several ways. I mean, in the openness, in how they're getting like open sourcing, in open source community, and so on. Personally, I don't quite understand the Apache funding side, finance side of things. If anyone in this group does, I mean, sharing some learnings from there would be useful. Another role model that come into the picture that was mentioned recently in the CL list, Common Logic mailing list, is that of Linux and Linus Torvalds. That obviously has been extremely successful, has much, much bigger impact than any other thing that I can almost think of, I mean, short of Apache. And OOR is that kind of a project, and we are looking at that sort of impact. So that would be a good, the role model we could follow. And consortiums, I mean, in this group now we have got Mike Bennett, I mean, at EDM Council. Maybe he can share with us some insights on, I mean, how, of course, EDM is properly funded because the consortium members are the people with the money. So maybe you can tell Mike or Shannon, I mean, can tell us a little bit more sort of the landscape there, and maybe Bob to working on sort of non sort of research type scenarios now these days, more than sort of research grant type work. So maybe everyone has some insights to share. Oh, I'll shut up now. Again, I mean, please click on the hand button so that we can cue people up to maybe make their remarks, suggestions, ask questions, and so on.
Terry, you wrote something in the chat room.
Mike's hand is up.
Mike Bennett.
Hi, just picking up Peter's point. So the EDM Council, its model is that it's a membership organization, and that actually predates any of the work we've done on semantics specifically. So it's an organization where each of our members pays annual membership dues, different amounts depending on the size and nature of their institution. And out of that, the council pays staff such as myself. And we've got five staff now. We've got people working on data maturity and data quality, and we've got myself working full-time on semantics. I think it's fair to say that what we can do with one paid member of staff is still not as much as we'd like to do. it's and we hit our members for a lot of their voluntary time and effort. So, you know, I created the draft of the ontology, and then we did a long series of subject matter expert reviews that people dialed into. So most of the work has been voluntary through people's buy-in and ownership of their membership of the association and the sense of getting some value out of it. So you know, we're constantly explaining to members what the ontology is for, how it can be used, what's in it for them, and in return we get free time and effort from them. But we are also looking to other sources of funding to try and extend and expand the core work that we're doing and technical proof of concepts and things like that that simply can't be done with volunteer effort or can't be done with particularly this one slightly non-technical member of staff. So I don't know if that helps, but that's the kind of the basic story of how we fund the work that we've been doing.
I have a question for Mike. Since you're fairly close to OMG as well, so would you say OMG, which I assume is also works on the membership model as
yeah.
well as like people like Oasis, I mean,
yep.
are they sort of fairly similar in terms of, I mean, getting most of their operating funding out of membership subscriptions?
Absolutely, yes. The OMG, like the EDM Council, has a small core of staff. I think the difference is in the OMG, there's nobody that works full-time on developing standards or modeling languages or anything. That's all done by a consortia of members who get together to design and propose the different standards that then go through the OMG process. So the OMG simply provides the kind of gatekeeping role for that. And again, all the effort is done by firms themselves investing their own time. I think with the OMG, there's a clearer business case for many of the firms in that many members are tool vendors, and the vendors want to produce tools that conform with the latest standards, and so they want to be the ones writing those standards, and so that tends to be how that works. So again, the common pattern here, and I think this goes back to your comments about Linux and so on, I know there's been studies done about how the open source model works, that basically it's down to what people see as their interest in giving their time for free. Only in the case of the OMG and the EDM Council, it's the firm rather than the individual who are, you know, providing their time and effort in return for some perceived benefit to them. And of course, as with Linux and so on, some perceived reputation benefits and so on.
Mike, how many members does the your council have?
Somewhere between 90 and 100 at the moment. And these are mostly banks, fund managers, data providers, and solution vendors in the financial space. And regulators now as well.
And regulators?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, but definitely the members are you know, institutions, companies.
Right, right. Yes. They have members like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and so on.
Yeah, it's all the tier one banks, or nearly all of them. And in fact, it's sometimes hard to keep track of who within those firms we've been working with. So Bank of America, we've got four or five things going on in parallel, and sometimes we know more about what different bits of them are doing than they do, as they're kind of finding us from different places. A similar thing a few years ago at Nordea Bank in Copenhagen, a couple of guys went researching to find somebody that was doing an ontology, and they eventually found us, and they invited us over, and only then did they discover the person sitting at the next desk from them was not only knew that the company was, that the bank was a member of the EDM Council, but they were actually on the board. And they didn't know about him, and he didn't know they were looking for us.
Okay. So, yeah, that's an interesting, that's definitely an interesting model. What kind of organization is it? I mean, is there...
We're a non-profit, a non-profit, US-based, I can't remember what the
US-based?
Yeah, so is it 501 or 901 or one of those sort of non-profit?
Yeah, I'm curious what classification you have, because there are quite a few.
Oh, right. If you go to edmcouncil.org, or if I go there even, it should say it, or I imagine it should. We're just rebuilding our website, so I'm not sure what's on there at the moment.
EDMCouncil.org.
Yep.
Let's see. About the council?
Yep.
It's a 501c6.
501c6. Thank you. I knew it was something like that.
Yeah, that's a good website. Explains it very well. So it's 501c6. I think standards organizations are usually that too, right?
I presume so, yes. I don't know what the range of U.S. institutions is, but yeah, they would be non-profits as well, I believe, because they, you know, take membership dues and feed it back into their activities.
I think they're classified as trade organizations.
Yes.
That sounds right, yes.
Trade organizations. And I just posted a link. The IRS calls them business leagues.
Oh, there's a nice leak.
Yeah, or Chamber of Commerce type
business
thing.
Leagues. Common business interests, and you promote such common interests. Right. Business leagues. I call them, in my slides, I call them consortiums, but... business league or trade association might be a better term for it.
Mm-hmm.
Trade, business league. Trade or association. And that's pretty typical of what standards organizations use as their classification.
Yes, the OMG has, I've forgotten this, they have different levels of sponsorship as well, which gives people a PR benefit in putting their name on the website as gold, silver, or bronze sponsors. I think we have some kind of sponsor structure as well, but it's not as extensive.
But they also have different rights in terms of the process as well.
Yes, because they have actually two sections. They have domain and platform members, and so domain members can propose standards that involve domain content but can't propose modeling language standards for platforms, and platform members can propose standards for modeling languages and other platform related stuff, but they can't propose domain stuff. And there's some kind of classification that goes across the two, but that's the two main things they do.
There's also contributors and influencers within each of the tabs.
Oh, yes.
So it's kind of a thing of the four-way matrix.
Right, yeah, I've forgotten them. So we actually have a relationship between the OMG and the EDM Council whereby we're both de facto members of each other and we don't pay each other any membership fees, and we're a de facto domain member. So that means that I'm a little bit hazy on some of the other structures at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. That's really helpful. So, Mike, do you have anything else to add about this?
No, I'm just typing up the other part of what I said in the chat thing.
Oh, great.
Great.
Okay, the next person is Terry.
Yeah.
Terry,
I've written some things on the chat board. I don't know whether they're actually germane anymore. But I think probably the bottom line for me is that this is not just an open source project, that you need to have a kind of a perpetual management body that not only looks at these things, but tries to make sure that they actually are integrated. I'm talking about the data, the content, of course. That much of the OOR talk up to this point has been creating the infrastructure for storing, ontologies or conceptual models or whatever you want to call them. But storing them is not managing them, and that there's a management issue that we have to somehow resolve. I think to get others to see an advantage in OOR.
That's certainly an important issue, and it's true. The at this point we just provide infrastructure for mapping, for example, but and infrastructure also for gatekeeping and basic quality control, but we haven't envisioned actually doing that ourselves.
What I was saying is that our business plan somehow has to show how you transition or how you deliver the code to the organization that does the management if you're not going to manage it yourself.
All right. Well, that's certainly an issue to consider here. Generally speaking, we've been very successful at convincing funding sources that it is an important infrastructure to develop. That does not seem to be a problem for us. Much more of a problem is convincing. I mean, is being able to match the mission statement of these funding sources. So that's why it does make sense to try to come up with some kind of trade association, business league, something like that.
I think the obvious example is BioPortal. They're managing that data as well as creating the infrastructure.
Actually, that's an important point. BioPortal, which actually is funded by a funding source, is only part of NCBO. That's just one of the things they do. Most of what they do is what you just said, the managing of the ontologies. So that's a good point to make.
That management of the ontologies is by default because they're running the servers. I don't think they're doing any active curating or anything, are they?
Being BioPortal or they being...
Or in NCBO or, and or BioPortal.
NCBO is much bigger than just BioPortal.
Oh, all right. But Terry's point had to do with managing the ontologies that people put in a repository. And I don't know that BioPortal and/or NCBO, the parent organization, is actively curating that content, as opposed to just running the servers and keeping the infrastructure running.
I thought they were. I thought NCBO was actually doing a curation thing.
Yeah, I think they are. If you look at the overall scope, I don't know whether it's totally in NCBO, but within the NIH funding, I think NIH has like 6 or 8 what they call the roadmap centers. The collection of those definitely would cover everything that we were talking about. But whether it's the mandate of NCBO as such, or even whether it's the mandate of BioPortal, I mean, that's something I don't know. But the overall scheme of things is that, I mean, they're managed, curated, researched into, constantly improved, and become an infrastructure that will support the continuing development and research and discoveries in the biomedical field. And to go back to Terry's question about whether our plan is to manage it or our plan is to produce the code and turn it over to somebody else to manage, then let's assume, at least unless we decide otherwise, that the OOR initiative actually is to develop the code, run the infrastructure, constantly improve, and so on and so forth, much like what the BioPortal would be doing for the biomedical field, but essentially doing that for all ontologies, of which biomedical should be looked at as one of the subset, part of the overall infrastructure. So
yeah,
to ask Mark Newson will say that BioPortal is a BioPortal OOR, just like if you ask Nancy Wiegand or Mike Dean or Gary Burkcross, and they'll say SOCOP OOR is part of OOR.
Okay. Let me explain, I think, what NCBO does. They provide ontology-based tools and resources. BioPortal is what they call a web-based resource. And what they do is develop new tools for applying ontologies. For biomedical investigation, you know, biomedical research, even clinical practice. But one key thing they do, and this is true of any of the NIH centers, is that they fund projects. So they're more like a whole program that funds other projects, and it's these other projects that actually do the curation, do the ontology development. So they act as a funding agency, in addition to being a project that produces software and infrastructure and doing research. So it's kind of an interesting concept. The center acts like it is in fact explicitly a funding agency in its own right. Well, I don't know that we would want to be doing that. That's certainly something you might consider, but I think that's perhaps a little too ambitious. The reason the NCBO does it is that was what the NIH wanted. They wanted to kind of decentralize, offload some of the work that they were doing for research funding. Okay, does that help? Terry, are you finished with what your comments were?
You can see them. I think that my big issue is really that the value proposition, somehow we have to prove or somehow we have to demonstrate that the value of the repository is in its ability to create valuable data content for some other community. So I'm done.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thanks for that. Okay, Shannon, you're next.
Thank you, and I'm sorry to, in some ways, clutter the screen here with a paste-in, but because, Peter, you mentioned Linux, I couldn't help but think of our client, Red Hat, as a potential model to study just for a few minutes, you know, after this call. People can obviously study this. But on their website, and many of you may know a lot more about Red Hat than I do, but my understanding is that Red Hat founded, or they went public in 99. And by the way, if you had invested in Red Hat just 3 years ago, you would have doubled or tripled, actually more than tripled your investment. But, you know, they are a billion-dollar revenue company, and they invest over $208 million last year in research and development. I don't know what portion of that $208 million is going to what they refer to in their SEC filings as third-party open source funding, but they do mention academic sources of the open source technologies that they are organizing and making into commercial products. So there's no doubt that they fund open source research. So thinking about Red Hat as a model, it may sound overly simplistic, is something I think just to consider.
Shannon.
Yes.
Do they, you said they fund research and other open source projects?
Yes, they do. I just read through their, 2011, 10K, and I can't tell what portion of the $200 million is going to their own internal R&D. I can't split it up, but I do know part of the $208 million does go outside to, third-party and academic open-source research, outside of their company.
Well, then, the question that comes to mind is, and Peter, maybe you have some views on this, does it make sense to partner with an organization such as Red Hat to support this development, and maybe they take it on as one of their service offerings? I don't know that they are into the semantic web at all, or anything semantic, but it would seem like a viable business or part of their business plan.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that. I know you're not posing that question to me, but actually over on LinkedIn, I happen to know this gentleman. Again, they are our client, and so we know them well. We represent them mostly in patent disputes. Interesting, though, that we represent them in that aspect of their business, even though they're based on open source technology. But I happen to know a gentleman by the name of John Ryan there, who is their I'll tell you what his title is. It's like Global Head of Business Development. He's actually based here in Atlanta. And I was going to tee up an email to him just to talk to him about this a little bit to get his views.
Well, are there any other views on that in the audience today? Peter, you seem to have the most business acumen among us, I believe, though maybe Ken has some also. I don't know. I don't want to diminish anyone's capabilities. I certainly don't.
You had a question a little earlier, and I forgot. What was it?
Well, is an option for OOR
to
align ourselves or some other similar organization, if they have funding to help support the initial development, it may be consistent with their business plan to take this on to provide the funding, and then they offer it again as a sort of a free product, and they provide services for it.
It's possible. I guess ontologies will have to be a lot more visible in the mainstream, which I think is happening. And if we went back 2 years ago to the Ontology Summit, when we predicted it's going to be totally there in 5 or 10 years, I still think we are on track. Let me continue. I don't think Red Hat does as much development as they sort of dress up, package up the product, and sell a supporting service. I mean, packaging up the product is a huge task. I mean, no doubt. But they take their sort of resource, the source from the open source community, essentially Linux, and things that get into Linux, I mean, possibly becomes part of the Red Hat distribution if Red Hat thinks that is good. There are semantic components in the Linux distribution, not people who are working with. Let me finish this one because it's quite important because some of us are actually working with them. The dairy people developed a thing called the semantic desktop. And semantic desktop is actually part of the Linux distribution. Some Linux distribution. I don't think it is part of the Red Hat distribution. So it's coming close, and it's definitely possible. The short answer is yes.
Well, I just wanted to point out, Peter, that Red Hat also provides some support in some fashion to JBoss, a real core infrastructure part of a lot of the web.
I think they actually own JBoss.
No, right. I think they.
I couldn't remember that for sure. Yeah. But again, they are somehow supporting the development of that code and then distributing it and making their money by services, if I understand their model, unless it's changed.
Absolutely, yes.
So, but the important point is Red Hat is supporting the infrastructure part, that rather tedious, boring part that no one's really interested in.
But do they actually develop it so much as repackage it and extend it?
In the case of JBoss, they do, but Mark Proctor's been very involved in WooML, and so he's actually a Red Hat employee through JBoss.
Well, maybe it's worth approaching them.
I mean, I'm wondering also if they may have some grant process or something like that for applying some of these third-party R&D investments, or if they tend to survey the landscape and see what might be hot. So one thing that's kind of getting packaged is a kind of a collection of linked data tools. Which is called, I think it's coming out of an EU-funded project called LOD2.
Well, yeah. Anyway, maybe it's worth, approaching them and see if we can get, what do you think? Should an individual approach them, or should we try to have a meeting where they're invited? What's the possibility there?
Yeah, I think
Shannon,
we will have to start.
Have some connection.
We would need to start from someone who knows someone. I mean, for example, if Mike has this colleague in the rules working group, then maybe that's Rule ML. Then maybe that's a starting point. I think calling them cold isn't going to get us anywhere.
Well, Shannon seemed like he had a good contact as well.
Yeah, and I'm happy to, I don't want to, obviously I'm the worst person to represent the group today, with Red Hat, but I'm happy to start a informal conversation with this gentleman that I know. I'll put his link on LinkedIn on the collaboration page here. But then, so that's one way. The second method that I could help facilitate some conversations is obviously because we work for Red Hat, I could make it, we could make more formal introductions through their executives, right? Their general counsel and CEO. I do not know those people, but our firm does. So I could certainly, and I'd feel comfortable having more informal conversations with my friend, and then I could report back what that person thinks.
Okay, great.
That would be great.
Yeah, that would be very helpful to try starting that process. Okay, thanks, Shannon. We better move on because we're going to be running out of time. The next person is Mike Dean.
I had a thought as you were talking about the foundations. Another option might be to join an existing foundation, particularly Apache could be a possibility. I've kind of, watched from a distance as the Jenna project, after HP Lab Bristol largely shut down, became an Apache incubator project. And it seems like it's been the transition has been fairly high overhead for them, but I think they and the incubator seems to be sort of a middle ground until things are firmly established. But I think ultimately that's, you know, a reasonable sustainment model. So it might be worth looking at the incubator project. I think that would probably be more for infrastructure and visibility than a funding source. But it also might be, assuming the goals align, you know, I think it would probably be a lot more straightforward than, you know, trying to essentially sort of duplicate a lot of the same organizational infrastructure that a group like that already has.
I don't know. You say it may not be a very big source of funding.
I assume that Apache isn't providing funding to the JETA folks. I don't actually know how that works, but
does anyone know how Apache gets funded? It's huge in terms of impact and in terms of things that they're doing, but how are they funded?
I think like Andy Seaborn, you know, became like one of the VPs of Apache as part of, you know, the JETA transition. I think their central staff is actually pretty modest.
Well, we would be modest too, but if as a funding source, Apache may not be that useful. There don't seem to be a really large organization.
Right.
But this is definitely worth considering. So, I mean, if we say we were to continue to pursue, do you have the right person to talk to?
Well, so one person would be Andy. So I see Andy's actually listed as VP of W3C Relations. Now, if you look at their organizational structure. And it looks like they essentially have a VP for each of their major projects, which is enormous list.
Can you put that in the
chat?
Yeah. I mean,
so that's someone else we could approach. Okay.
So to finish this point, if you have it your way, and you make all the calls for OOR, would you pursue that?
Is that you asking me?
Yes.
Well, I think you'd lose some independence, but I think, you know, you gain a fair amount of helpful infrastructure, name recognition, and so forth. So I think it would not be a bad outcome.
But is infrastructure and name recognition our sort of bottlenecks or stumbling blocks?
Well,
no.
I think the Apache name would probably could contribute some to proposals and so forth. It might also help improve visibility within the large developer community.
Yeah, you might be able to get more volunteers that way to contribute code, to work on it.
Yeah.
If they saw it as an Apache project.
Right.
On the other hand, Apache has a lot of projects.
Right.
I don't know the number, but it's pretty large, and I imagine nearly all of them are, well, a fairly large fraction of them are pretty quiet. They really don't have much happening. So just being a project, Apache project, doesn't guarantee that you'll actually get interest.
Right.
I mean, they have a long list here, and they also have this incubation phase, which Jenna is still in.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is kind of a middle ground for something that could become an Apache project.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So let's
okay, great. Mike, could you take the lead on this?
Yeah, I can look and see what that might be involved there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's move on. Michael?
I have two points. One is, do we have a document that actually kind of outlines what our resource requirements would be? Right? So if we were to write a proposal as if, you know, we wanted this to be fully funded by some organization, I mean, do we really have this idea of saying, you know, here are the goals, the objectives that we want to do in terms of software, in terms of curation, et cetera. And in order to achieve this within a particular time frame, we need the following resources.
We have some proposals of that nature. But that we've
For the full project? Okay.
Yeah, for the full project. It was a pretty substantial, somewhat
open-ended.
No, I think it was a specific proposal that we made that was fairly complete in terms of what we wanted to do at that time anyway. We might not want to do the same thing now.
So what was the resources that were requested there?
Oh, boy, I'd have to look it up. I think it was,
very nominal.
I thought there was one we had like a 1.25 million, something like that.
That high?
Okay, so realistic then. Where are these documents located?
I can see if I can find them.
I included that in the resources for today in today's session page.
Really?
Is that all there? Let's see if it's there.
It's a thing called.
Where are the resources?
So which one is open? What's this proposal team only? I see. Okay.
Yeah. Let me.
Earlier OOR.
Guys, a password. Hang on. You need a password to get in there. Okay.
So because at the other one, that NSF, the first one there, the 3EBF, there's nothing there. I mean, there's text there, but I don't see a proposal.
Yeah, we had an actual Office of Cyber Infrastructure. That was one. This is a program where the 5-year awards could be as much as $20 million.
Okay, I just posted that. Username, password to the message archive, the discussion, and the share files. The share files, I believe there's a the documented things as we submitted them.
Right. I'll give you an idea. Although the awards could be as much as $20 million, I believe they wanted it to be substantially lower than that if it was actually going to be funded. So
I'm just kind of saying a proposal in which it's pie in the sky or I wish we had this money. It's like, what do we realistically need to do to get what do we realistically need in order to get the minimal amount of software infrastructure up there so that it can become self-sustaining in an open source sort of way?
I think those are two different questions. One is sort of a development cost and sustainability depends partly on a business model that would allow continuous income when it's in operation mode, which we don't have.
We don't even have a prototype. You know, if we had a prototype, like, what do we need to get to a prototype? Let's put it that way.
Well, we have a prototype. I mean, the sandbox, which is running, is a prototype, or SOCOP OOR is some sort of a prototype.
I don't know if it's enough that you could actually take it to an open source community and say, okay, let's build it from here. But anyway, that leads me to my second point, which was in terms of prototypes, the AntoHub part of, you know, one of the other instantiations, which is also kind of proceeding on its own in Bremen. And I mean, they have some nominal funding, but they seem to be doing quite a bit with it. Another data point is I heard that in earlier meetings we talked about the Tones repository at Manchester, and I talked about migrating it over to one of the instances. Well, I just found out that Bijan Parsha is kind of resurrecting that project. I think they want to call it Phones instead of Tones, or Finding Ontologies. And I think it's going to be a Google hosted on Google code. So I'm not sure what funding he has. Although some bad news was that, I don't know if people remember, last fall there was a bit of a debate, and Bijan Parsha got rather pissed off with the OOR list and quit in a big huff, like intentionally unsubscribed from the list because of this argument about the vision of OOR, I think. And so I'm not sure how easy it's going to be to get him back in the fold to kind of work with us, as opposed to working in parallel in an effort that might not be even interoperable with what we're doing.
Was Bijan Parsha's argument on the OOR list, or was it on Ontolog?
It was on OOR. At one point, I think Ali Hashemi kind of said, well, you know, if you're saying these kinds of things, why are you, you know, kind of contributing to the OOR list? And Bijan said, you're right. Why am I? I quit. I want off this list.
We've always had a strained relationship with Kendall Clark to start with. Actually, Bijan was quite okay and slightly more neutral. But I guess that goes back all the way to relationships that sort of splits the formal ontologist versus the semantic web people.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes that far. So it's not sort of incidental. I remember at one point in time, we have an Ontolog member by the name of Andy Shane, who then became Chief Technology Officer for NASA. And Andy works fairly well with me, and works fairly well with Clark and Parsha, because, I mean, they commissioned them to do some sort of work. And at one point, Andy brought us together and said, I mean, you guys don't argue. I mean, you've both been very helpful. And sort of past that, I think Bijan subscribed back to some of our lists, but shortly. I mean, that was sort of the point. I mean, he started not feeling that's the kind of position he wants to even get close to, and they quit. I mean, I think this is sort of semantic web versus formal ontologists, and you can't change either one of them.
Right. I guess my overall point, though, was that, I mean, if some of these other ontology repository efforts start competing with OOR rather than working with OOR, I'm not sure how we're going to kind of deal with that in a way.
But would they be able to compete on the actual business and semantic sides, or would they just create a newer, faster, shinier technology, which may not be such a big deal?
Well, if you're trying to get attention as being, you know, the place to be for developing an open ontology repository, and then there's other people making similar noise, it sort of then become competitors.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, but that's part of life.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been nice. I mean, if we are all under the same roof, but it's not happening quite yet. And we have other things to worry about. And they do, too.
I don't know. I mean, up to this point, we have never had anyone say to us, oh, no, we're not going to fund you because somebody else is doing that.
Mm.
we've never actually encountered that.
Well, it's also just kind of, you know, if we could be leveraging other work, that'd be good. And so I guess that was maybe another side point was, is there other ways that we can kind of be working with other projects that are kind of already ongoing and kind of pool resources that way?
I think that that's exactly what we've been trying to do.
Yeah.
With the sort of zero resource model. And if you look at OR.net, I mean, it's the fact that we're even listing, I mean, the Colores and OntoHub and ORNLDAC and MMI and BioPortal, I mean, on one page is quite an accomplishment. But we are not taking those that very far, and we haven't really leveraged everyone yet, because I mean not everyone is engaged as, let's say, Colore or SOCOP.
Right. So then just with my first point then, so I finally found the updated project description from, I guess it looks like November 6, 2008. Would this be something that we would want to, I know, either update or slightly rewrite and use that as something to take to people when kind of looking for funding or working together on something jointly for funding?
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea, actually. My point in the slides was that wherever we go for funding, we would have to establish, you know, the make a case, basically. That's what they call merit. And we've already been actually fairly successful at most of the criteria, and to the extent that we don't fit, haven't been good at all of these criteria, there are things that we could fix. So we do have proposals that I think we can certainly use in making the case for various funding sources.
Okay.
We would need to tweak them and, you know, adjust them. And of course, pay attention to trying to make sure that our mission, our statement, which we do, who put that on the chat? We actually have the review of the OOR mission.
Yeah, right? Bob Smith. Yeah.
Bob Smith, thanks. He put this up. We want to make sure that our mission is compatible with the mission of the funding source, so that you know, we don't have any conflicts, and so they would see this as part of their mission.
Right.
So that's an important issue. But, I mean, I think all of those are definitely doable, and we do have material that we can use for making this case to organizations. And that would be a good way to proceed now. For example, when we approach Red Hat or Apache, or, you know, if we wanted to build an independent business league trade or association, I think that would be the kind of foundation we could use for those approaches.
Okay. So I guess this would be the newest document than this one from 2008, the last NSF proposal. So it's
Do you have a link
to what you're reading or what you're referring to?
It was one of the
like 15 of those. Which one are you talking about?
Well, it's the one where you posted. It was the discussion archives.
Discussion archives.
The link after the discussion archives is a link to a whole set of files 1 through 14 of different
layers. Yeah, 15 through 14. So that's why I was wondering.
Sorry, yeah, let me get
exactly
it here.
What's the one?
Okay, here we are. Sorry for all the wrong postings. There we go. That's where I found the description.pdf file.
Oh, fantastic.
I mean, it seems like it's all still relevant, even if it's a couple of years old now.
Yeah, I would say so. One problem with these these funding agencies is that the it can take over a year to give you a response. Some of them were just remarkable in how long it took them to finally come back with anything, you know, any kind of statement of what they're going to do. I just looked at my own records, and I show proposals dated in 2008, 2009, 2011. So we've certainly been active trying to get funding. Anyway, it's past 1 p.m. I think it's time we wrap this up.
So maybe one more action item. Maybe can you look at that write-up and bring it up to date, if at all?
Yeah, I'll look at the various write-ups, the various proposals, and try to come up with something that we could use as the kind of the template for approaching the various organizations for funding. Okay?
Okay. Yeah.
So I think it's time then we adjourn. Thanks to everybody. It's been a really very productive meeting. We should probably have a follow-up meeting to this meeting when some of these action items are completed. Any thought about when we should meet again? How long it might take? No suggestions?
Yeah, I would suggest we actively pursue this.
Yeah, I'm saying, you know, we should keep this going and actually think about having another meeting, say, in a month. Does that sound reasonable?
That sounds good, but maybe we should also look at opportunities, because some of those have a deadline, and then we might want to sort of peg to those deadlines and meet accordingly.
We didn't really identify any.
Yeah, we identified a few in the last maybe year or two, but we never really had the incentive to actively pursue, and most of them came and went. Actually,
right,
the
right.
More
I'm
recent
talking about
ones on big data would have been good, but I think they're mostly past now.
No, I was talking about the things that have been brought up today.
Yeah, oh yes.
And have a follow-up meeting dealing with these issues, with these possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Does everyone think of another meeting within about a month would be reasonable?
Our dates in the next month is pretty much taken up. So the next open date is October 30th. Wow.
October 30th?
Yeah, almost a little more than 2 months. I can still book
really?
That date yet.
There's something on October 2nd?
I am going to be away, so I was suggesting we don't meet on the 25th and the 2nd.
Oh,
earlier,
I
suggested that. If you don't mind. But if you insist on meeting, then that date is open.
Well, anyway, let's not discuss this now. I'll announce a date for a new meeting in perhaps 2 months from now. Okay, so
all right.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay, thanks. Great meeting. Thank you very much, Ken, for all the preparation.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.